Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a podcast which is presented by FGI. We are going to have a chat with a key person in our world, someone who we know, and that could be a sponsor, a lender, or an advisor. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Chris Hawes, who we have known at FGI for a long time. And many of you will know Chris as well. He has been an ABL lender for a long time, many years, and recently, very recently, perfect timing, just flipped across into the world of advisory. So this is a perfect moment to talk to Chris. And not only that, but Chris is a great friend. So hello, welcome, Chris. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Jo. Thank you for asking me. I'm honoured to be here and talking to you. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you. And before we get into some more sort of nitty-gritty, I know that over the last few months you've been doing a bit of walking around Scotland.
Yeah.
So tell me, how's that been? What did you do?
Well, I had a little bit of time in the garden, and I haven't got a very big garden, so I'd walked around that too many times. So I just thought, and funnily enough, actually, I bumped into somebody. It was one of those strange conversations. I'd been running up on the South Downs, and I was standing outside the local artisan bakery waiting for my coffee, very Lewis, where I live. And this somebody just came up to me, and she said, "Hey, you know, where have you been? What have you been doing?" And I said, "I've been up on the ridge." She said, "Oh, we've just got back from walking the West Highland Way." And I went, "Oh, I've always wanted to do that. What's it like?" And she said, "Don't try and do it in 5 days." But she said, "It's gorgeous." So I thought, right, I've got a bit of time. I'm going to walk the West Highland Way. So it starts on the edge of Glasgow in a nice suburb, which is spelt completely different to how it's pronounced. I think it's pronounced Mulgai, but it's spelt Milngavie. And then it heads 96 miles north up the west coast of Scotland, round Loch Lomond, through Glencoe, and up to Ben Nevis, which on the last day, which you don't want to climb on the last day. So fortunately, you walk around most of the really steep stuff. It follows old drover's roads and old military roads through some of the most incredible scenery in the British Isles, I think. It is absolutely glorious.
Fantastic. And how was that? Were there some highs and lows? What were the good bits? What were the bad bits?
Good bits. I think we were pretty lucky, actually. We had a glorious day of sunshine around Loch Lomond, but then the next day it was pretty much like walking in a washing machine. It just rained heavily all day. And that was one of the toughest parts of the walk. You're scrambling around Loch Lomond on a path that's barely there, over tree roots, over rocks and stuff like that, in the rain for 6 or 7 hours, you know. So that's the downside. I mean, the upside, I think, was probably the longest day of walking, which was 20 miles across, I think it's Rannoch Moor. And as you're coming towards the end of it, you just come out into the incredible U-shaped glacial valley of Glencoe. You pass the bottom of the ski lifts, and there's this hotel just sat in the middle. I think it's called King's House Hotel, which has recently been refurbished. And you see this hotel in the base of the valley and the road running down the middle of it. And it's just stunning. It's absolutely beautiful. So I came, but it's difficult to come back. I was tempted, because you can walk about another 70 miles up to Inverness. And I was almost tempted to do that, but I had to come back.
Well, for anyone listening, that's a wonderful tour guide to Scotland. There you go. You have it here from Chris, where to go if you want to walk in Scotland. So thanks for the travel bit on that, Chris. Fantastic. So, I mean, obviously, Chris, you and I have known each other for quite a few years now, and I guess the thing I never asked you and always wanted to know is, how did you get into initially the world of ABL? I don't think we've ever discussed that, but I'd like to know, and I'm sure people listening would be interested. How did you fall into it?
Well, I got an email from my son's tutor this week, and normally when I get an email about my son's tutor, it's oh God, what's he done now? And this one was very positive. And the conversation started to go on to what he might want to do after formal education. And the tutor actually said, your son doesn't know what you do, so we had to look on LinkedIn. Anyway, the upshot of this is that my son doesn't want to work in an office, but there you go. This is the true story, Joe. This is the true story. I was living in Birmingham in a rather interesting flat with some rather interesting neighbours in not the more salubrious part of Birmingham. And I was working for a bank. And my girlfriend at the time, who was a classically trained musician, and a bit mad as well, but sensible in some ways, she came home with the evening paper and there was a job advert and it said, you need a car. This job comes with a car. And you could do that. And it was for International Factors, which was back in those days owned by Lloyds Bank. I think they had three separate factoring companies, the Alex Laurie and TSB. And she said, you could do that. And I applied. And so that's how it happened. I got the accounts for the company and stuff like that, had a look at them, had an interview in Meriden where their offices were, then got the train down to Brighton for the second interview. And I saw Brighton. I thought, oh, this is a nice place as well. And got offered the job as a field examiner. Was my first job. So I got to drive around. I got to see lots of different insides of different companies and got much of a clue what I was doing, clearly, at the start, but just really, really enjoyed the energy, the variety of businesses that you saw, people, and the attitude was very different to, you know, where I'd been working in banking. So that's how it was, more or less an accident. And the other story, which when I was in the final interview, and bear in mind that I had gone mainly because it came with a fully expensed company car at the time, we started haggling over the salary, and they offered me a salary, and I decided that wasn't enough, and I wanted £500 more a year. And the guy said, well, that's above the salary grade. And he said, and I said, I don't care. I want another £500. And he said, well, you know, this job comes with a car, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, do you mind if I ask you what you drive at the moment? I said, yes, I do mind. Just sat there and looked at him until they went, oh, all right, 500 quid. You can have it. And that was it. That was my first negotiation in this industry.
Well, it worked. It did. Definitely worked. So, I mean, really, the driver for you was mainly the car, by the sound of it.
I didn't know anything really about the industry. I knew it was financial services. Mm-hmm. I knew it was client related. But I mean, this was, you know, back in the day when, I guess it was, there was still a lot of still factoring around. Invoice discounting was probably new and radical and stuff like that. ABL hadn't even been thought of, I don't think, in this country at that point. So this was, you know, a fairly niche industry, and one could argue it's more niche than it should be now still, which we'll touch on in a bit, I'm sure, in terms of why I thought PwC was such a great opportunity. It seemed to build on, you know, some of the skills that I had, whether they were, you know, financial services, client-facing, risk-related, et cetera, et cetera. But it came with a shiny car, so it seemed much better.
Okay, very good. I like that start. But, I mean, obviously, let's flip forward and you spent a large part of your career at RBS, which is, to my mind, where you see the real kind of push into ABL. And a very big growth, how did that amazing opportunity come to you to sort of get involved with RBS, which as to my memory at the time, had a very small ABL kind of function. It wasn't a big part of what they did.
Yeah. I think, you know, really, I mean, I'd spent the previous 6 years or so at GE, GE Capital Commercial Finance, you know, and been across to the US and worked with some, very experienced US ABL practitioners. So I'd kind of got a bit of a feeling about, you know, mid-market, how ABL was the go-to financing, what it could deliver beyond just a factoring or receivables structure, and seeing how the preponderance of its use in the US, and got, you know, pretty excited about it, and learned an awful lot from those guys as well. So I suppose my pitch, in a way, to Martin Morin at the time, was, you know, an RBS, despite what happened to the investment bank, RBS was, at the time, market-leading corporate bank in the UK, very good corporate lender, market-leading invoice financier in the UK, grown very successfully, and then was, you know, and had been brought back under control by Martin very, very successfully as well, and now looking to grow. And my pitch was really, look, you're market-leading here, but you're nowhere in ABL. This is what you could do. They had set up a corporate business, which was mainly cutting and slicing the existing book. But I just thought there was an opportunity to introduce, I suppose, more coherently and consistently, a US-style ABL approach into the UK market.
And you know, you grew a team, which had been relatively small numbers. I mean, probably sub 10 people. In something quite substantial. But not only that, you grew a book of over $1 billion in the space of what, 5-6 years, really? There was a very intense period of time. I mean, what does it take to do that? Is it a combination of things? Is it a bit of luck? What would you say was the main takeaway from that extraordinary growth period?
Yeah, I mean, I think we hit $2 billion, Joe, actually.
Oh, sorry, apologies.
I'm sure we did. No, not that I'm prickly about these things at all.
I'm prickly about these things
quite a while.
It was an extraordinary growth, that I know.
Yeah. It was. So there was a number of things, really, and, you know, one was that it was a good existing business. Yeah, in terms of RBSIF was already a great business. I have to say, great leadership under Martin Morin, because me going into a big organization, what Martin provided for me, and we only fell out a couple of times, mainly my fault rather than his, but he provided the air cover in terms of allowing me and the team to be entrepreneurial in the business. He's a good credit guy as well as a very wise mentor and a very wise counsel for me. So having that, and not just the air cover, but the advice and the support, the energy that he had and the wisdom he had, that was important for me as well. And I think, therefore, being allowed to bring in new ideas, and also then bring in a diverse set of people, Joe, I think, as well. So, and changing it by some of the people we brought in were not necessarily ABL people completely, but we felt we could train the people on the ABL side. We looked to bring, you know, it's a cliche, isn't it, trying to surround yourself with people smarter than you, but we just tried to bring in really smart people.
Well, thank you so much, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
I've really enjoyed our conversation, and it's always great to be talking to a smart person like you. Thank you very much indeed for your time today. And to everyone listening, really appreciate you tuning in to part one of talking to Chris Hawes in his podcast, and very much looking forward to you joining us all for part two, when we talk about what Chris has been doing more recently and bring things up to date. Thank you once again. Look forward to seeing you very soon. Bye-bye now.